Yes, he was a recluse. Yes, he let his fingernails and toenails grow 3 inches long. Yes, he was a codeine-addicted, obsessive-compulsive who isolated himself from friends and family. But before all of that, Howard Hughes established some of the most glamorous records in aviation history. Fastest across the country, fastest around the world, and fastest overall. This younger Howard Hughes, pilot, playboy, and movie maker, is the subject of Martin Scorsese's new movie, The Aviator. It's also the focus of a new biography called Howard Hughes Aviator, written by a former test pilot at Hughes Aircraft. If you have questions about Howard Hughes, the flyer, industrialist, and aviation pioneer, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us, TOTN@NPR.org. Author George Marrett joins us now from the studios of member station KAZU in Pacific Grove, California. And it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Well, it's great to be on with you, Neil.
Your time at Hughes came long after Hughes himself was flying. But for this book, you spoke with a lot of people who did fly with and for him, many of them talking about their legendary boss for the first time. What did they tell you about Howard Hughes, the man?
Well, a lot of the mechanics that worked on the airplanes that I flew with Hughes Aircraft Company worked on my airplanes, and the same was true of some of the elder test pilots. At the time that I worked with Hughes Aircraft Company, it was still a private company owned by Howard Hughes, and it was kind of generally known that whatever you heard at the company, you kept it there. He was a very private individual, and so there were a lot of Howard Hughes stories that went around among employees, but you didn't tell it to non-employees. So I went back and interviewed 17 people that had a direct connection with Howard Hughes, strictly in aviation, mm-hmm. and that's the basis for my book.
Mm-hmm. And as a test pilot yourself, you know a lot about some of the things he went through.
Yes, and there's many books obviously written on Howard Hughes, 26, 27 by my count. But when I read through them, none of them were written by a pilot. So I think they got some of the aviation stories a little wrong. So when I went out then to interview these older people, now the oldest one I interviewed was 96 years old, the youngest 81, they were very, very pleased for me to tell the true story, the nonfiction account of Howard Hughes, the aviator, because they thought he had been kind of maligned in history, being remembered by his end rather than his early days.
Not to say that there aren't some strange incidents as well as, of course, all these wonderful records that he established. And of course, he established a major American corporation.
That's right. He was just, there's no one else like Howard Hughes that accomplished so many things in the field of aviation, movies, and the oil business. He was just a one-of-a-kind person, both pluses and minuses.
Tell us about some of both. I mean, first, the pluses, and on one level, he was a terrific pilot.
He was a terrific pilot. He, like so many people of his generation, listened to Lindbergh when he went across the Atlantic in May of 1927. And Howard got kind of entranced by the hero worship that Lindbergh received, and so he decided that he wanted to become an aviator and see if there were records that he could set. And this was at a time period when one person could come up with an unusual plan and could, in fact, set records. Lindbergh did not have independent wealth. That's why he ended up getting money from the businessman of St. Louis, which is the name of his airplane, the Spirit of St. Louis. Howard Hughes had independent wealth, and so he could spend his own money, hire his own designers, his own people to make airplanes, and as it turns out, in 1935, he built a plane called the Racer that's now in the Air and Space Museum back in Washington, and he set a world speed record of 352 miles per hour. That was, a great, great event for him.
You write, for that brief period, 1935 to 1938, Howard Hughes could do no wrong as far as the press was concerned. He was described as the young man who looked like Gary Cooper and flew like Lindbergh, and indeed, in some respects, you say, eclipsed Lindbergh.
I think he really did. Not only did he set this world speed record, but he was kind of reckless in flying his airplane in 35, ran it out of gas, and landed gear up in a beet field, so he damaged the airplane. However, then he set his sights on a transcontinental record, which in this case would be from Burbank, California, to the East Coast at Newark. And he bought an airplane from Jocelyn Cochran, put a new engine on it in early 1936, went nonstop at night in about 9.5 hours to the East Coast. The following year, his Racer now had been repaired and also had a larger wing and more fuel, and he went nonstop again in early 1937, same route again, at night again, in 7.5 hours. And when you stop and think of it, we're talking about 1937, so many years ago, and only 7.5 hours. The best you can do now in a commercial airplane is about 5 hours. Then he set his sight on a round-the-world flight, and in 1938, he went around the world in a twin-engine airplane. This time, he did not fly solo. He flew with two navigators, a flight mechanic, and a radio man, and he did that in about 3 days and 19 hours. So he owned these four records, and so by the end of the 30s, he was considered by many people a better aviator than Lindbergh.
Quite an accomplishment, and Lindbergh, no mean flyer himself, of course. The questions that many people have, though, are this mental illness that consumed him later in life, did it manifest itself in his flying at all?
I think to a degree it did, but his flying also enhanced it. What happened, the movie makes quite a case that he had this obsessive compulsive disorder, which I believe he did. But he also had 8 automobile and aircraft accidents during his flying time period. And this was at a time period when if you had an automobile accident, there was no seatbelt. So if you hit a tree or a telephone pole, you ended up with a head injury. Hughes was hurt very badly in some of those accidents with the head injuries, and in 1946 he had a major accident when he flew his XF-11 spy plane through 2 homes in Beverly Hills. He was in the hospital for 35 days, was on morphine for that length of time because of his burns and severe pain. Later, as he left the hospital, they transitioned him into codeine, and he remained hooked on codeine the rest of his life. So I think it was a combination of the disorder, the accident, head injuries, and the drug addiction that really knocked him downhill.
You quote one of his contemporaries, a man named Meador, quoted in Robert Serling's book, Howard Hughes Airline, An Informal History of TWA. Howard Hughes seemed to be a lonely man grasping for a little touch of companionship in the cell of isolation he had constructed for himself. It was a cell whose blocks were composed of suspicion, fear, distrust, and wariness directed toward anything that remotely challenged his wealth, control, and power. Hughes preferred flying solo and enjoyed spending time alone. What Bill Meador witnessed was that rare moment when Hughes stepped out of his cell to share with another person his love of airplanes and flying. Tell us about that moment.
Well, that is absolutely so true. He had a passion for aviation, and I'm a pilot, so I've flown solo, and there is probably no greater experience than to be in an airplane and know that you're totally responsible for your own life. You make the takeoff, you navigate, and you land. And so there is this great feeling of aviation, of power. And Howard Hughes was an in-control person. He, like I write in the book, he set the goals. He supervised the construction. He flew the flight. He did it all. It was his way. And people that were, had different opinions, he let them go. So he really did not have any lifetime friendships or relationships as we think of them. So he was an independent person. And it seems like the only time he really let his hair down is when he was with some of his mechanics and his co-pilots. He was big in aviation. They were big in aviation. They spoke the same language, and they got along quite well.
In fact, at least one of them would call him Howard to his face, at least in private.
Yes, he wanted to be called Mr. Hughes in public, but they got away with Howard when they were together. And it's interesting, people referred to him, not in his presence, as the old man, even though he was quite a bit younger, or called him the man, kind of a colloquial expression. The man is what he was referred to.
We're speaking with George J. Marrett. His new book is Howard Hughes, Aviator. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Now we have a caller, Mark from Denver, Colorado.
Good morning.
Good morning where you are. Good afternoon where we are.
I have a question for the author. I guess it was in the late 40s, Howard Hughes had one of these pet projects. It was this enormous seaplane referred to as the Spruce Goose. And what I'd heard was that while it was being designed, he realized that it wouldn't fly. It really wasn't going to work. It wouldn't fly out of ground effect. and I was wondering why he went through with that project and test flew it if he knew this. Do you have any insight to that at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, he actually did fly the airplane in 1947. He only flew it one flight for about a minute, got around 70 feet in the air. But to back up from that, he signed a contract with the U.S. government in 1943, initially to build three of these aircraft. As time went on, they reduced it to just one, and he was given millions of dollars by the U.S. government to produce the airplane. He spent a lot of his own money, but he was very involved with the design of the airplane, and he made certain that the airplane was going to fly. It was, again, a passion of his that he had accepted this contract, and he was going to fly the airplane.
He didn't seem to have a lot of faith in it, though, as far as...
Well, it was the government, really, that lost faith in it as the need for this aircraft evaporated. Isn't that right?
Yes, there was the idea behind the airplane would be that it could fly 750 troops between the East Coast of the United States and England at a time period when the merchant ships were going across there and being sunk by Nazi submarines. So the idea was to overfly it.
Go
ahead.
What was the cause of him to give up aviation as far as flying is?
Well, he flew, the latest he flew was in 1973, actually, in England, and I interviewed a fellow by the name of Jack Reel, who's 89 now. My book starts with Jack and ends with Jack, and Jack was a retired Lockheed engineer and was with Hughes the last 19 years of his life, and he made arrangements for Hughes to get four flights with a British test pilot flying a Hawker Siddeley twin-engine jet aircraft in England in 1973. And Howard bought a couple of the airplanes, was going to get back into flying, but he fell, broke his hip, and never got out of bed again in the last 4 years of his life, last 3 years of his life.
I see.
Mark, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Let's get another caller in, and this is Dave. Dave's calling from Cleveland.
Hi.
Hi.
I lived in Las Vegas in the 70s, when Howard Hughes did.
When we were more concerned with the length of his toenails than with his aviation.
But I read a fascinating book by Joe Kloss about the Amelia Earhart case, and then, you know, now they're trying to revisit that possibility. In short, the author suggested that Hughes was led to believe that the Japanese had Amelia Earhart, and that he provided and adapted the designs of the Hughes racer into the airplane that the Japanese suddenly seemed to have, that was this amazing airplane, the Mitsubishi Zero. I'd like to see what your guest says about that. I'll just listen on air.
Okay, Dave, thank you.
I think the only indication that I found is that the Japanese, in fact, took photographs of the racer and felt, obviously, it set a world speed record, so it seemed to be the correct way to go from a design point of view. And so they kind of replicated that with their Japanese Zero. But Howard Hughes had nothing to do with that.
Mm-hmm. In the 30 seconds we have left with you, I know you've seen the picture. What do you think of it?
Oh, it's a great great one. I saw it about 2 weeks ago, got a chance to meet DiCaprio. He was interested in asking me about whether he had played the part of Howard Hughes correctly. I thought he did a dynamite job. I thought he just did a super job. The movie's up for 6 Golden Globes, and it's really an epic 2 hours and 45 minutes. It's right up there with English Patient and Lawrence of Arabia, as far as I'm concerned. I think they did a super job.
Martin Scorsese's film The Aviator opens, I think, nationwide on Christmas Day. Howard Hughes' Aviator is the new biography by George J. Merritt, and we thank him for his time today. Appreciate it.
Well, I'm actually been interviewed by Miramax, and I'm going to be on the DVD that comes out afterwards, about 3 months after the movie comes out, as a talking head. So
you make the director's cut. How about that?
That's right. It's really great to be on that.
George Merritt joined us from the studios of member station KAZU in Pacific Grove, California. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.